Good morning, Will.
Morning, Rohan. How's it going?
Very well, very well, as always.
Nice to hear. Nice to hear.
How are
Yeah.
you?
Good. Yeah. Very well. I've been
Okay.
having some. I think I've been sleeping funny, but my shoulder keeps hurting. So I'm hoping I'm just sleeping funny and not have caused irreparable damage.
I've done a few shoulder replacements in my days, so
Okay. I'll let you know if it gets
if
bad.
it gets really bad.
Okay. Nice. Good to know I've got that.
Yeah.
In the background. Yeah. No. Other than that, really good.
I got some good news yesterday. We put an offer in on the house, which was accepted.
Oh, cool.
So I've been looking for about a year now.
Yeah.
So finally moving to Oxford.
Whereabouts is the.
It's a little village called Wheatley. I mean, I say little, it's a fairly big village.
Yeah. So there was a there's a Brooks campus in
Yeah,
Wheatley or
exactly.
something, yeah.
Yeah, so looking forward to that. So just
Nice.
got to frantically try and get done before the stamp duty holiday finishes.
Yeah. Okay. But no, that's cool. Was
Yeah.
it Was did it were there other people bidding for it? Were you unsure?
So we used a buying agent for this one. It worked really well. So he found the property off market. So no one even knew it was on the market.
Okay.
So he managed to snag it before,
Okay.
which was really, really nice. Well, hopefully we have completion on paperwork and things dependent.
Yeah. But I mean, that sounds quite exciting. When's move-in day?
Well, we're hoping 30th of June. 30th of June, no
Okay.
later, but
Yeah.
it'll be exciting.
Very exciting. Okay. Well, that's obviously something to look forward to. In the meantime,
Yeah.
we've got a chat today about vaccines, about health screening, which I think is very topical at the moment.
Yeah, so we're kind of foraying into the public health territory. But I
Yeah.
think it's important.
Yeah.
So, often I think people, when I was in med school, we used to have public health lectures, and I was guilty of this, as we just used to drone out because when you're a doctor, or even a scientist, it's more sexy to kind of cure patients who are dead, or give them
Yeah.
CPR or look after really unwell patients, because that's the stuff you're going to see in the soaps. But I think public health essentially is about prevention rather than
Yeah.
curing. So as to, if it does its job properly, we need less healthcare physicians.
Yeah.
Because the population is healthier.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a really, really important thing. Probably no one's ever looked at it as closely as people are looking at it now, because before it was just public health professionals weren't, they were kind of shouting a lot about how important certain things were, but I think people
Yeah,
just
no one
didn't
was
notice
paying
it.
attention.
Yeah. So hopefully this will kind of shake things up dramatically.
Yeah, and I think it's different because on an individual doctor's level, I don't think it will make much difference. Obviously, maybe you
No.
see more people related to a certain public health issue, but when you're running, in charge of a GP surgery or running a number of hospitals or in charge of the NHS, suddenly it becomes an enormous issue, which
Yeah.
is costing a lot of money. I think we're going to talk another time about other public health issues, but just a bit of scope. I was reading that Public Health England was saying that all the money that goes into tackling, treating for obesity and sort of diabetes related to obesity, they spend more on that than they do on the police and the fire department. And that's a huge amount of money to be spending on it, which is supposedly preventable, or at least somewhat preventable. And again, the individual doctor doesn't make a huge difference, but on the population country scale, it's very
Yeah.
big.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the argument there always has to be there's a compromise, because just because a group of individuals and government think that this is better for the overall good of the country,
Yeah.
at what point does that erode into civil liberty? So there's always that trade-off.
Yeah.
So for example, I think I'm sure we'll kind of come on to it, but things like adding stuff to water, I think some people feel quite uncomfortable if the government mandated certain things like fluoride
Yeah.
to be added to water.
Yeah.
So whereas actually it's a very, very reasonable thing to do.
And I think this is where sort of these two different episodes are going to be quite different, because I think vaccination and screening isn't too intrusive on your own freedoms, whereas other public health issues, because they are so down to the individual, you kind of do have to intrude a bit in order to make a difference. Whereas I don't think many people, and well, actually, some people do feel very infringed by a vaccine,
Yeah.
And that's something which I was quite surprised by over the last year. You know, it's not something which really would bother me that much. If you told me how to live my life 7 days a week, yeah, that's irritating. But coming in for a vaccine once, or well, twice, I suppose, it doesn't seem as infringing. But people
I like your notion that just if someone's telling you to live your life 7 days, are suddenly mildly irritated.
have.
A very low threshold.
Yeah, I guess sort of from the from like a dietary position,
Right. As opposed to you must writing your schedule out for you.
yeah. I think, you know, obviously the government, and particularly this government, I suppose, doesn't want to be seen as over meddling, and different governments do things different ways. You know, some people pay more attention and government's more involved.
Just interesting on that, just that dietary element that was in the news last night, the Queen's Speech bans all junk foods from being advertised online. I mean, that's huge.
Oh wow, I missed that.
So it's just these kind of small interventions that can be made at a higher level, which can have huge ramifications. I agree with you. I think an individual doctor probably won't experience the benefits of public health unless they really take a step back and look at the data. Things like mesothelioma, which is a cancer you get from asbestos exposure, that was obviously banned, but we won't see the impact of that for several decades. So we're still seeing cases, but there will be a generation of doctors who will never see, or hopefully never see, mesotheliomas again. Wouldn't that be great? But they won't know that that was because of
Because
this,
of that.
because of legislation. So it's one of those really boring, really important topics.
I guess we should probably actually, maybe, because some listeners won't know, I mean, difficult to not know what a vaccine is these days, but health screening, is not completely intuitive what it is. Could you sort of explain a
Yeah,
little bit?
so essentially it's a generally it's a population-wide process that is followed in order to allow for detection of diseases or illnesses that would go on to cause major problems later on. So you may have heard of things like the Wellman check at 60.
Yes, for bowel cancer.
Prostate cancer, bowel cancer. There's things like breast cancer screening. The most recent one was cervical cancer. Every woman above the age of, I think, 20, 21, 23 has to go for cervical smears at their GP every few years, for example. And that's quite an invasive thing, because obviously those are genital swabs essentially. But it's been shown to kind of result in early detection of very preventable and very well. Very treatable conditions, which if you catch them early can save a lot of lives. So it's good obviously for the individual because they're allowed, they're being saved a lot of hassle, stress, money, etc. But it also saves the NHS and the country a lot of resources as well. There's loads of kind of arguments for one when a public screening is effective, but it tends to be things that we look for are, is it easily preventable? So is it easily detectable? If it is detectable, can we actually do anything about it? So for example, we don't do brain cancer screening because if we do catch it, in most cases,
It's nothing.
there's very little we can do. Second is how common it is. So if it's a very rare condition, there's no point in scanning for it. It doesn't all only go for adult diseases like cancers, so we use cancer as quite a big example, but if you go the other extreme, newborns, that's the type of screening. So every time a child is born, we test them for four or five genetic disorders. Every single child in the UK undergoes this.
And what does the test look like? Is it like a just taking a DNA sample?
It's, yeah, exactly. Or sometimes I look for markers in the blood, so things like sickle cell, thalassemia, but all and you know some of the metabolic disorders. And if they're not detected, then that can cause huge problems from a social perspective. Imagine like a really worried mum or dad. Constantly calling the GP, constantly calling social services, a dietitian, because a child is vomiting all the time. That's really stressful. So if they can identify all of those things, make plans, and actually that child can lead a relatively normal life. So it's just screening. Sometimes it's kind of thought of as, I think when people think of health screening, they think of kind of going to a hospital and being put through and poked and prodded with lots of needles. Actually, it doesn't have to be that. It can just happen much, much earlier, and it can be a lot less invasive than
And I guess so thinking of the different things that they screen for, I guess prostate cancer is a good example of one which is very common, is very detectable, and is very preventable if caught early. And, you know, if not caught, it can sort of stay there for a really long time.
Yeah, so the thing they used to drum into medical school, when I was in med school, into us, was that I think most people will die with prostate cancer rather than because of prostate cancer.
Yeah.
So if you kind of do an autopsy, I think on people of the age of 70, obviously men, of the age of 70, I think it's something absurd, like more than 50% have some cancerous prostate or precancerous cells.
Yeah. Is it for any reason in particular that part of the body?
So it tends to be just rapidly dividing tissues are more likely to make mistakes when they multiply.
Okay.
So the more likely something it is to replicate, the more likely you are for errors, and the more likely it is for cancer. It's why generally most cancers arise in adulthood.
Yeah.
So there's very few cancers that actually happen when you're a child, because essentially cancer is a disease of aging, if you think about it. Because the more times you multiply, the older you are, and therefore the more likely you are to get mistakes, the more likely you are to get cancer. So things like bowel cancer is a really common example, because bowel is probably one of the most commonly multiplying pieces of tissue.
Okay.
And that's why. And there's other, you know, there's other reasons why things like lung and breast can, of course, have cancers in, but that tends to be very different.
Okay. And so obviously health screening, very, very important. And, you know, they sort of, I guess there's ongoing research into which and when, you know, which things should be screened and when they should be screened.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be, or at least from what I've seen, there doesn't seem to be too much objection to health screening, at least in the UK. Did they talk about that much at all at university?
So we didn't really touch upon it. I think that the key thing is it's an opt-in mechanism. So if you didn't want to go for a cervical screen or, you know, a blood test, no one's going to force you to. No one's going to fine you, for example, for poor concordance. So it's very much an opt-in. But I agree with you. I think most people generally see the benefits of it. And I think we do things generally pretty reasonably in the UK. America takes it to a whole new level. So they've literally got vans. They go around the streets and they've literally got MRIs built into these vans.
Wow.
And you can pay, I think it's about $1,000.
Yeah.
And you step into the van, they'll do a full body MRI. And then you'll get that reported. Now, if I asked you that right now, you'd probably say, well, I don't need it, $1,000. But actually, someone in their 40s to 60s, they'd probably be interested. And there's a certain percentage of people who do end up with them. And as you can imagine, quite a few of them turn up. Well, they're called incidentalomas, or incidentalomas.
It sounds like it's a tough word. Yeah. So.
Well, essentially means it's anything which is benign and potentially cancerous, we call an oma.
Okay.
It's like the suffix. So it's an incidental cancer that's been detected.
Okay.
And again, it may not result in anything, but because they found it, they now have to investigate it, which can lead to a lot of work. So again, on a population basis, those MRIs probably don't make a huge amount of sense. But to an individual, because of the confirmation biases that will arise, you know, you'll hear stories of, well, my doctor said nothing was wrong with me. I went into a van, got an MRI, and then found a breast lump, and now I'm fine. Those kind of things are really, those are anecdotal evidence, but it doesn't stand up for public. You can't roll out that to a whole population because of the cost of doing so. We can't MRI every single person over 40, for instance.
Yeah, and I was going to say, so, you know, in sort of sci-fi films, you'll see a doctor come up and they just sort of scan someone quickly and they'll say, oh, you have a tumor or whatever it is. And obviously we're not there.
No.
And you need to be, well, as a sort of a body, the NHS needs to be careful with how they're using those resources. Those vans don't matter because they're just, you're getting paid directly.
And they're private, essentially. Yeah. Just on that note, actually, a long time ago, I think about 10 years ago, there was a company in America which came out with an outrageous claim, which just sounded so good to be true, but actually people went along with it.
Okay.
So they said that using a centiliter of blood, which is a tenth of a mil, they could run about 26 serum, biochemical and hematological tests.
Okay.
Which, you know, implausibly, you'd think, well, that's a lot of tests to do with a lot of, with very little blood. And, you know, when I used to work in the NHS, we used to have to send entire vials, so literally like 5, 10 mils sometimes, maybe not 10, but 5 at least per vial to do certain tests. So for them to be able to do that was just outrageous. And actually, people bought into it. There was almost no due diligence done on this company. Paid millions and millions. And actually, the founder kind of said this, sold this dream, and then she got so went along with it. And essentially, what happened was at the end of that story, they got caught. So you
They
know,
couldn't do it at
they
all.
couldn't do it at all. They just fabricated it. I think they hoped that they'd be able to do it at one point, but they were just never able to do it. So, you know, it just goes to show that sometimes when people make these wild accusations and claims, it's really important to do your own research. And what I really wanted to focus on was in this kind of episode was scientific literacy, because I think often people just don't, you know, they'll read something on Facebook and just think that's absolutely correct. And just that the world looks different if you're a scientist. Like when you see a ball bouncing, you don't see just like literally a ball bouncing on the floor. You see a set of differential equations that are there to be solved. For example, when you see a sign, the Leaning Tower of Pisa, you don't see kind of essentially a full name of a building. You see the angles that are required to maintain it, the force and thrust.
And I guess in this scenario, when you see a claim saying you need to do this, you think, well, what was the sample size? How did they test it? Those kind of things.
So I think often as a population, that's one of the things I think schools don't teach that well. It's kind of thinking critically and seeing, does this actually behave with the scientific laws that
Yeah,
we know
definitely,
exist?
definitely.
And, you know, it's just one of my pains when someone comes to me, because we talked about this, is you'll see something in a research paper will say this X molecule works to cure this very specific type of cancer in the specific subset of mice. And then that will be taught at university, relatively watered down. This drug works in these types of cancer. And then by the time it gets into the Guardian or the Daily Mail, it'll say something like miracle drug,
Yeah, miracle cure.
miracle cure for cancer.
And I think we've obviously seen that a lot this last year in terms of vaccination. And it also seems to be somewhat, there seems to be a relationship between where you are in the world as well. Because in the UK, there's been quite a few sort of anti-lockdown, anti-vaccination demonstrations, but not nearly as many, or at least there hasn't been as much exposure of them as I've seen in the States. There also seems to be a lot of distrust, and this was, so I mean, not recently, but I've previously been sort of looking at, the polio effort and sort of vaccinations going on for longer standing diseases than COVID. And they often say that you sort of get stuck in certain countries where people are much more distrusting of modern medicine. So, there can be diseases which are totally wiped out everywhere, except for two countries where it's just really difficult to get the locals to sort of interact with it. And I think that is purely a science literacy, and it's not their fault. They're just not sort of taught that well. And we're saying here that we don't think we teach it fantastically at school in the UK, where the education system is relatively well set up. But there are going to be countries where there's no mention of vaccines or anything like that. So when someone comes over and says, "I'm going to jab this needle into your arm and it's going to make everything
It's
okay,"
got bits of mercury and various biological agents in it.
You can understand why you wouldn't trust it. And
And you know, they're being scientific just with, so it's a very reasonable thing to say. I mean, if I came at you with a needle filled with COVID and mercury and various other metal, heavy metals in it, then you'd probably say, no, thanks, Ryan. Or at least I hope you
It'd be a strange
would.
policy to start on Monday mornings. Everyone gets their mercury jab.
But yeah, it's a good point, and I think so those that rationale that these aren't people that in most cases they're not being difficult and they don't have a particular agenda, is they're just looking out for their own interest. And I think that's important to understand as a scientific community. And you know, there's a really good documentary on flat earthers on Netflix.
Okay, I think I might have seen this one.
I mean, we'll do a flat earth episode,
Yeah,
I'm
I look
sure, in the
forward to
future. But the key thing there is why. I mean, obviously you can kind of, you know, be very derogatory towards these people, but there is scientific method to
it.
the way they work, and they are trying to gather evidence, or at least some of them are. And I think it's just they've been misguided. And actually, I think it's a real shame that what could have been really promising scientific talent has kind of ended up not being nurtured or mentored, and instead ended up into this kind of twisted version of science.
So yeah, but I think there is a there's an approach to science which is often missed, and that is you're not there to prove things, you're there to disprove things and then take what's left. And I think with a lot of and again we'll get onto this again with Flat Earth, but in that scenario it's very much they're trying to prove something. And the issue is if you have a long-standing idea of what's right, you're less likely to, and you do research and the research says, well, actually, it's not right, you're less likely to listen to that, and then you can sort of you refuse it because of some other thing. So I think that that's a really important thing, that no scientist should be trying to prove something. You're sort of trying to disprove it as much as possible, and then when you find out it can't be disproved, you then say, okay, well, this is probably the best answer that we have.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when I try and explain this to kind of kids, that the best way to kind of try and summarize it is, imagine you're at the edge of a forest, and essentially it's a really dense forest, you don't know where to go. The wrong way to do it is to essentially, you know that there's an answer in that forest somewhere, or something of interest in that forest. The wrong way to do that is you say the hut is in the middle of the forest, and that's where I want to go. And as you go into the forest, you see signs telling you the hut is to the left or the hut is to the right. But actually, so no, I know the hut is in the middle. So you carry on going straight into it. And there's more and more signs, there's more lighting, there's a no entry barrier. And you keep going through it. You ignore all the kind of signs that are telling you don't go further.
I like that analogy.
And actually, you get into the middle and it's not there. And you start searching around, you start digging a hole in the middle of the forest to see, well, the hut must be here. I knew it. Whereas actually the scientific, the empirical approach is you step in, you see what the world around you looks like, what it tells you, and then you follow the signs and the evidence. And hopefully, if you do that, it may lead you to a hut, or even more excitingly, it may lead you somewhere else.
And you know, we sort of say, oh, it's obvious that's the way it should be done. It is tricky to keep that going, particularly if you know, if you've been doing 5 years of research and the basis of that research says this is the answer, and someone else does another piece of research and says, actually, no, you're wrong. It's difficult because
It
you know,
is.
you are intrinsically linked to that.
And you've spent so much of your life kind of, that essentially that piece of work becomes your baby. I mean, I experienced this when I wrote my dissertation, is there was I ended up writing my entire dissertation based on a premise, which was that bone is determined by your bone density is determined by essentially how much you exercise, and then from there onwards determined by your genes. That was like the kind of general premise. And then this new group came out about a couple of months before I finished and submitted, and they said, actually, no, it's nothing to do with that, it's to do with what you eat. And I was like, goodness sakes, like, and I've actually done any proper first degree research at that point. But I felt really like personally attacked, even though they probably didn't know me at all. But actually, that research was pivotal, because then based on that, we were able to make advances over the last few years in osteoporotic drugs, for example. But if I'd ignored that, I mean, it probably wouldn't have had a big impact if I'd ignored it personally. But other people, if they took a similar approach, who knows what could happen.
And I think that the issue, certainly with what we're seeing at the moment, is the over-reliance on anecdotes to inform people about things like vaccination. So, you know, lots of people say, well, you know, I've got a cousin who was really unwell after it, so I don't really want to have the vaccine myself. And again, you can understand why. That is evidence that they are seeing and interpreting, but it's so important to sort of almost completely disregard any anecdotes, particularly with something like this, where it's being done on millions and millions of people now. One or two here or there is really small, and I think it's mostly, and things might have developed, but when there were the sort of blood clot issues, I mean, there still are, I think they're still investigating it, but when that first sort of fired up a couple months ago, it was quite a divisive topic, because on the one hand you had these various European countries just sort of saying we're putting it on hold completely because we're not sure, and then other bodies saying, well, actually, hold on, it's not got any increased risk on just in the ordinary population. And the issue is when you do have something which is done to so many people, there's going to be bad things happening afterwards.
And again, it's all about correlation versus causation.
Mm.
So when I was when a few months ago, there were kind of rumors emanating from Oxford Hospital, mm-hmm. Cambridge Hospital, that some of the trial volunteers that were undergoing the vaccine trials had developed a very rare disease called, potentially developed a rare disease called Guillain-Barré. Essentially, it's a type of vasculitis which can lead to paralysis. So it's pretty serious.
Yeah.
And you normally get it after exposure to certain types of viruses. Generally tends to be respiratory or gut viruses instead.
Is it due to the virus or sort of an immune response?
So it's an immune response is the kind of leading theory. So it's an autoimmune response.
Okay.
And obviously we've not seen something like this with COVID before. So the theory was, gosh, could this just be a autoimmune vasculitis that's mediated as in response to the COVID vaccine?
Yeah.
Because if it is, that's a huge risk.
Yeah.
Actually, the brightest minds in the country are working on it. What the question they had to answer was, is would this person have gone on to develop this disease anyway because they had a cold or they had a diarrheal-like illness a few months ago? Or did the vaccine cause? Actually, that's a really difficult thing to work out.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not just it's not just my grand got the vaccine, she got really ill, therefore the vaccine causes it. That's a very broken fallacy. Really what we need to be certain of is, if you could go back in time and not give them the vaccine, would they still have got this disease? And actually, that's very difficult to do.
Yeah, we don't have the technology. We don't have for the time.
Yeah. One day.
Yeah, eventually, once we do have that, it's going to make so many things so much easier to study.
Yeah.
But until then, lots of people are like, oh, time travel, amazing. I'd go back and see the Romans. Not me. I'd rather just do good empirical research with it. Nice trials, same sample, exact same conditions.
Yeah.
Ideal.
Yeah. Some people would rather go forward and win the lottery, but not you. Well, you're a man of science.
No. We've got more important things to do. Yeah. No, I think it is tricky because, you know, we've said it's potentially an issue of education. It's also an issue of the way that news is presented to people.
Mm.
It's also an issue of the fact that, you know, it's easier to, or it's easier to sell information which is shocking and distressing.
Sure.
So you are the sort of world set up against you as an individual to be, you know, to respond well to these things.
Yeah, I've always wondered about this. Is there a phenomenon, Will, that describes why we like bad news more than we like good news?
I'm not sure. You know, not that I know.
Is that a thing? It feels like that because obviously the media is kind of very rarely will you read good news on the media. You know? I mean, we vaccinated half the population, yet that's barely made a big deal. I think that's an amazing achievement.
Yeah. So there are definitely phenomena that you overestimate the prevalence of things based on how often you hear about them. Mm. So you know, which is why people sort of way overestimate shark deaths, deaths by knife crime or whatever it is, because that's all that you hear about.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, it's relatively low in comparison to other stuff. But I don't know if there's been someone's put their name towards the fascination with bad stuff happening.
You know what? When you go do masters,
that could be the start. Yeah.
That could be the weekly effect.
See, this is the thing. I've often wondered with people who do put their names towards effects or, you know, phenomena which are really not nice. Are they happy with that? Because
like Alzheimer's, for example.
Yeah, because you know, obviously, that work is very important work to do. Something like working with Alzheimer's and you know, trying to at that point actually notify it as an issue and sort of rather than trying to cure it. But your name is then forever associated with a very difficult, not nice, and you know, near to end of life disease.
Mm.
And I think that's a tough legacy to have. So if we do find a phenomenon about people loving horrible stuff, maybe I'll call it something else. Maybe I'll name it after my younger brother or something instead.
I hope your younger brother listens to some of these.
I don't know whether he will. I'm sure he's very busy with, I don't know, but he often tells me he's very busy. So,
Call of Duty. Here's
yeah,
all the
so,
rage.
that and as with me, really, you go through phases of things that you just sort of play a lot or read a lot or sort of fixate on. And, whatever it is, I'm sure he's got better things to do than listen to me rambling on.
I suppose in medicine, actually, there's been a big move away from eponyms, and we kind of talked about it in the past as kind of, obviously removing and dishonoring or discrediting the Nazi scientists is probably the first step. But actually, we're trying to move towards not using eponyms or kind fancy names based for diseases based on people. Trying to move more towards things that actually describe the disease
Yeah, for a more
for a
practical.
more practical thing. I mean, it still doesn't help that much. I mean, and sometimes it can actually just create more work to kind of learn, especially
But I
for.
do think so, learning completely separate pieces of information and sort of joining them up together is quite difficult. You learn the name and then you learn what it is, and then you have to make an association between these two things rather than the name actually sort of tells you what it is,
True.
and what it is tells you what the name would be.
And I've tried to, when I used to teach secondary school kids, I used to try and tell them the wonders of science, because the words in science tell you what something is. Very rarely is something in science named, apart from medicine, where we just Latinize everything and use eponyms. Generally, in most pieces of science, especially physics, everything kind of tells you. And so I used to get this exercise where I'd ask them, give me every single word that in science, and I would just break it down, and it would be really obvious. So examples would be thermodynamics and the laws of thermo. Well, that would just be thermo comes from heat, and dynamics is just movement, so it's the movement of heat. And that's really obvious then. So those kind of, and again, that's part of scientific literacy. It's just understanding what key terms mean. One of my biggest kind of pain points with the UK education is it's considered cool if you don't know science and maths. And I think that's just a travesty. I mean, I was never that cool at school, so it's probably a little bit of personal stuff there. But I think,
Use that time machine and go back, make it cool.
I think that's a travesty that it's cool to say I can't do maths. It's cool to say I can't do science. And I think that then perpetuates people who are kind of on the cusp of actually, they perhaps enjoy science, enjoy maths. They kind of want to be cool, inverted commas, to migrate towards that crowd. And then it starts to become a self-fulfilling cohort, which, obviously long-term doesn't benefit the individuals or society as much as it potentially could have.
Yeah, and you can go from, as a teenager, sort of being a bit disenfranchised with science, and but still listening to your doctor, having your vaccine, trusting medical literature, even if you're not too bothered about it. Whereas if you sort of put yourself in an echo chamber, sort of 10, 20 years down the line, you can slowly sort of polarize yourself towards, no longer trusting the medical literature, now being suspicious of vaccines. And people don't decide overnight that they don't trust the NHS or the public health officials typically. It's usually a longer term process, and it can be a long term process which wasn't associated with vaccines. So I read a book about sort of conspiracy theorists, and generally people who believe in one conspiracy theory, even if the other conspiracy theory is completely unrelated, they're much more likely to accept it and sort of believe it. Because ultimately, the base line of any conspiracy theory is I reject the narrative which is being sort of proposed. And if you reject the narrative that's being proposed here, you can reject it somewhere else. So it might be, someone who's never even thought about public health, but they don't believe the earth is round. And then they can, you can very easily transport that thinking to any other kind of field or scenario.
So, well, do you think it's a desire to go against mass thinking? Because that's quite, I mean, sometimes it's cool to be a rebel and not follow mainstream thinking. Sometimes people feel they're leading a revolution, or that they know something that others don't. But for people to believe that about four or five fairly concrete phenomena, things like vaccines that say if the earth is round, chemtrails exist, all of these kind of things.
Yeah.
For them to believe so strongly in each of those without having had done primary research to support their own hypotheses.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a psychological element to that?
So there certainly is. So humans generally are meaning seekers. We find meaning in places where there aren't any. We will assume that there's a loaded dice if we see three sixes in a row, even though that's probably by probability, that's completely possible and that's a completely viable option.
Mm-hmm.
So you know,
it's a sign from above, for example.
Yeah, or you know, someone's trying to cheat me out of some money here.
Yeah.
And so whenever you have these kind of events, which can be somewhat divisive, you know, moon landing, 9/11, you can find meaning in lots and lots of little things, which might just be completely, just statistically, they just happened. And so when you start finding meaning in these things, you then need to think, well, what caused these things? And, you know, no one's talking about these things. No one said this has caused this. So there must be something else going on here.
Mm.
And so that's the sort of the logical conclusion if you're sort of ascribing meaning to these events.
Mm.
And again, if we look at the vaccine rollout, you could find lots and lots of hidden meanings if you really tried and really wanted to. I'm trying to think of an example, but you could say, you know, why have they rolled out so quickly? That's never happened before. Maybe there's something, you know, maybe there's
actually
a reason.
I've heard that a few times from, you know, relatively educated people.
Yeah.
So sometimes people say, well, what's going on?
Yeah. And so it's, but this builds up and up and up until you develop a sort of a bit of a narrative and a worldview. It's very difficult to change someone's view of the world, and they will do everything they can to further push it on, because ultimately you are very fixed to the worldview. That there's lots of ideas that having a worldview sort of helps you live longer insofar as you're sort of part of something bigger. And one of the common traits that they see in sort of conspiracy theorists is that somehow just telling people about the conspiracy theory is like the way to dissolve it. So, and this is what, you know, 9/11 people, moon landing people, they spend the whole time trying to tell other people, because there's some kind of understanding that if I tell someone, that's going to unravel everything. And so you see it, you know, you see it with the vaccine. People have seen things happen. They've ascribed meaning to things which have other explanations or are just by chance. You know, there's a with the moon landing, there's, well, why was the flag going straight? You know, there's no wind on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on here? Oh, well, you know, we knew that because we're scientists. And we thought, well, we don't want to have like a saggy flag. It's going to be terrible. We're trying to beat the communists here. We need a nice, rigid flag. So we're going to sort of straighten it up.
Is that what they did? I heard that it was because they planted the flag so hard and because there's no atmosphere on the moon, that the ripples
interesting.
Allowed it to carry on moving and stay upright.
So I had understood that they just had a thing, like it was just
like a wire that
you
goes
have a flagpole wire along the top, or, you know, rigid wire along the top,
yeah.
And then flag sort of hangs down from it. The fact that there are multiple explanations is pretty fishy, though.
Yeah.
And so you can see why this happens. I think we're lucky insofar as we've got a pretty good healthcare system in the UK. Health screening and vaccine giving is done very sensibly and not sort of done rashly. You know, they don't suddenly say everyone above the age of 18, we're now going to do this. You know, it usually takes a long time to implement. And so it's a broadly acceptable thing for a population to go along with it. I can imagine if you're in a country that's never had a vaccine before and now all of a sudden vaccines are happening, that's a huge jump. And so, you know, I guess one thing that they need to do is actually work out how can we we've got the science, we can help people, but one thing that then we haven't been able to do yet it perfectly is make sure that people are happy with it. And again, it's not, we'll talk about diet and we'll talk about sort of smoking and all that kind of thing. It's not telling people to behave differently necessarily.
No, it's just nudging.
It's nudging, and it's giving them a treatment or a potential treatment that they might need.
And I guess there's a political element to it, which we're, you know, kind of glossing over, which is vaccines aren't actually mandatory, at least in the UK. And I think if they were, then the government would be liable for any damage as a result. So they're, it's being promoted heavily by by individuals and companies, but not by the government. It's kind of, it's available if you want it.
Yeah.
And obviously everyone's going to want it. So that's obviously a different dynamic.
And that's what, you know, the government will say, we can't, we're not aiming to vaccinate everyone because some people will refuse. So of everyone who's offered, we want to vaccine.
Yeah, sure.
Of everyone who accepts, basically.
So I guess we should, we didn't get into like big depth on vaccines, but we've covered quite a few principles. Like, I guess it's time to start wrapping up. I think we've kind of agreed that the rollout of a vaccine is dependent on the success, not just of the science behind it, but also the population and their willingness to go along with it.
Yeah, definitely.
So there's perhaps more to just developing and delivering a vaccine than just creating it.
It is interesting. So one thing that I suppose isn't vaccine or screening related, which is great for me to bring it up as we're wrapping up. but I think last year they made organ donation opt out rather than opt in, which is obviously quite a big change. But actually, you know, for something like that, I think for the majority of the population, they would be okay with that. And so there's sort of an acceptance of it. And I think one of the things that they need to be thinking about when they're trying to roll something out is actually, you know, for the ordinary person, how much of a deal is this? And I imagine they have like focus groups and things like that. I'd be
surprised
if they
that's probably more of a political decision than a scientific one at that point. Interesting. So, well, any interesting facts for us this week?
This is related to vaccines. There's been a team of researchers in Holland who've basically, whilst, you know, we've all been in lockdown, they've been working very, very hard. And they've trained bees to poke their tongue out when they smell coronavirus.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's, I mean, bees aren't normally animals that you think of training. But
I didn't even know they had tongues.
So, and also presumably their tongues are so small
that you can't
that you have
it.
To sort of be with a magnifying glass. Is it out? Yeah, the tongue's poking out. You're ill.
I mean, I have so many questions, so I don't know where to start.
So, I won't know all the answers, but the idea is, well, firstly, one of the longer term implications could be, you know, can we use bees more effectively? At the moment, sniffer dogs are used a lot in different kind of scenarios, but if you can train a bee to smell COVID, you can probably train it to smell explosives or anything like that.
Interesting.
I don't think they've actually rolled out the bees yet, but what one obvious thing would be to have them at airports. You know, if you're a country with either high or low COVID, you sort of go through your passport control, the man scans your passport.
And he goes through a swarm of bees.
Bee on his shoulder.
Oh, okay, yours is much nicer.
Yeah, so I guess they'd have to make them non-stinging bees. But it's only...
How do you look at the bee? Because presumably it's buzzing around, so you have to make it stay still to then look at it with a microscope. Well, not a microscope, but a magnifying glass or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I guess you could... There's probably an AI you could train to spot bee tongues. But that's...
That's a lot of effort.
That's pretty elaborate.
Compared to a lateral flow.
Yes. So obviously, you know, the counter argument is, well, we've got a pretty good way of testing someone.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, if it's quicker, doesn't require all the, because, you know, one thing that I've been wary of in the lockdown and with tests and all this kind of thing is the kind of waste and all the packaging that goes into it.
Yeah.
A bee is a very eco-friendly alternative, which might be the
I think sometimes people say, well, what's the point of that research? And I have huge problems when people say that, because something may not have immediate consequences now, in next year, in 5 years, in 10 years, in your own lifetime.
Yeah.
But it will have some impact on someone's life in the future at some point. There's countless examples of research that was done literally hundreds of years ago,
yeah,
or even decades ago, and we found, and it's impacted technology right now to this day.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, if every research paper is citing sort of 40 or 50 others, then you know actually it's going to contribute to something. And it's not necessarily, and you know, research doesn't necessarily go the way you think it will, but it could still have an effect, which again wouldn't be seen if you've not predicted that.
And it's slow. Research is slow. I think, you know, people forget how long it takes to do even just something simple that you lay fast. Them, how long did it take to map the protein structure of hemoglobin? They'd probably say, I don't know, maybe a few weeks or a month. It took 4 or 5 years of several people working on it. So it's just, research is slow and it takes time, but it does work and it does deliver long term. But that's probably a different discussion. Not that I'm very passionate about that at all.
Yeah, I think that will probably be a reigning theme across the different stuff that we talk about.
My disappointment at the British education system. So my interesting fact, it kind of ties into what you touched upon, which is time travel.
Okay.
Which is, you said it'd be cool to go back in time to do research better.
Yeah.
Or it might be cool to go back and see the Romans. Well, time travel is possible.
Okay.
I hope you're listening very carefully now. It's possible in the future, into the future. So, for example, if you're in a very high speed moving object, then because of essentially Einstein's special relativity theories, time will pass slower for you if you're traveling close to the speed of light than people who are traveling at normal velocities. So, for example, if you went on a really fast plane around the Earth, like for a long period of time, so fast that you're approaching the speed of light, and then came back, and you had a twin brother, you'd be substantially older, substantially younger than your twin brother, because more time would have passed for them than you.
Yeah.
But you can actually go back in time. It just requires you to move faster than the speed of light, which, as far as we know, isn't possible right now.
But is it also impossible? So forwards in time, close to the speed of light, back in time, faster than the speed of light. Isn't, because doesn't your mass have to become close to zero?
Which is why we can't do it right now. Okay. But imagine a hypothetical scenario. Say you could, right now, if you could teleport to a planet 65 million light years away from the Earth.
Yeah.
And on that planet is a little nice little balcony with a telescope powerful enough to look at the Earth. You would be witnessing an asteroid hitting the Earth, and you'd watch all the dinosaurs die out.
Yeah.
So really the only thing
sadistic.
Stopping
is
a great spectacle, I'm sure. It is possible in theory. It's just there is a inertial barrier that prevents us from doing this. I think sometimes people think of it as time travel as this barrier. It's not. It's the space travel combined with time. So it's space-time that you kind of have to travel back in, not just one dimension. But I'm sure we can discuss that another time as well.
Yeah, okay. Awesome.
Right. Oh, good catching up with you.
Yeah, nice to speak with you.